Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes burning up my lungs. Had to taste of one too many lips hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Sunday morning getting high, drinking here alone. Thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
People who, like the founder of the show, recognize they're on a dangerous path and make the difficult adjustment to be an amazing person, share poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength, capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulder, deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. This is part sinner, part saint, part of Late Night Poets on Blog Talk Radio. And Late Night Poets is a group on allpoetry.com. You don't have to be in our group to participate, but it's more fun if you are. You can chat with us in the chat and read along as we do. I'm Afaziana, and with me I have Babbler. Hello, Babbler.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, happy Christmas Eve Eve. I think it's still the Eve. Yeah, well, yeah, it's a pretty low-key Christmas over here. Like, basically no plans, just me and my husband hanging out. You have anything exciting happening?
My brother's coming up tomorrow if the ice sheet melts. And my mom, and we'll probably have dinner at my place. I'll be making a prime rib.
That's good.
And the weather here is terrible, though.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it goes.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty icy. I think it was minus 30 today here. So I'm thinking Celsius. I don't know Fahrenheit. But really freaking cold is the general consensus. And a fair amount of slow snow.
Yeah, it's been pretty cold here. It's been about 10 Fahrenheit. I think it's like negative, I don't know, like 26 or something like that, which is bizarrely cold. And then there was like one freak day that where my brother and sister lived, that was like negative 45 Fahrenheit, which is extremely cold.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I think it's like negative 42 Celsius. So, cold. Very cold.
Yeah.
And everything's machine device.
Yeah.
I've seen some things where people are like making fun of, Seattleites because they can't drive in it or whatever. But I don't think people quite understand the difference between the Pacific Northwest versus the Midwest. And that's hills. Everything is hills. There's no flat.
Yeah.
It's all on hills.
Same here. It's different. Everything is hills. Like, even, like, I went over to a friend's house yesterday, or the day before yesterday. I've totally lost track. But their driveway alone is, like, a freaking hill. I'm like, you could slide down this just by, like, sitting down on the ground. You just go like a water slide kind of thing. But ice. Yeah, the hills make a big difference. I looked it up. Minus 30 Celsius, which is what we are here, is minus 22 Fahrenheit. So we're around the same cold.
Cold. No one's going outside. Nope.
I mean, I did the shovel, but that was, you know, the half hour that I could handle. So your contest is the feature of tonight. Will you tell us about your contest?
Absolutely. So tonight's contest is based on a short story by Truman Capote called A Christmas Memory. So, you know, it's that time of year, the holiday season, and it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Things are getting cold out there, like we just talked about. So I just thought I'd take a look at this short story. It's an interesting short story. It's an autobiographical story, mostly. It's interesting because it's like a fictionalized autobiographical story from Truman Capote. It's narrated from the first person's perspective of a 7-year-old named Buddy, and it tells the story of him and his cousin and their holiday camaraderie as they prepare for Christmas before he moves away forever. So I selected some quotes to go ahead and inspire it. So there was no need to read the short story. It is a great short story, but it was not required in order to write the poem. So here are the inspiration quotes that I pulled. One, it's bad enough in life to do without something you want, but confound it, what gets my goat is not being able to give somebody something you want them to have. The second quote, and when that happens, I know it. A message saying so merely confirms a piece of news some secret vein has already received, severing from me an irreplaceable part of myself, letting it loose like a kite on a broken string. That is why, walking across the school campus on this particular December morning, I keep searching the sky, as if I expected to see, rather like hearts, a lost pair of kites hurrying towards heaven. The third quote, it's fruitcake weather. When you're grown up, will we still be friends? Fifth quote, one by one the household emerges, looking as though they'd like to kill us both. But it's Christmas, so they can't. The sixth quote, morning, frozen rime lusters the grass. The sun, round as an orange and orange as hot weather moons, balances on the horizon, burnishes the silver winter woods. A wild turkey calls. A renegade hog hunts in the undergrowth. So those were the quotes that I pulled, but I welcomed anyone to pull any expert or excerpt or inspiration from the piece that they felt inspired to do so. So that was the contest for this week.
Well, I'm looking forward to the writer's response to it, and I've sorted them by prompt, if they said what prompt. So we're going to get started on prompt one, and the first entry is from Liquid Mind Forever. So I'm going to give that a read. This is A Christmas Prayer by Liquid Mind Forever. Ice and sleet freeze and crack concrete streets as you lie on your back against cold stainless steel bed rails with liquid sleep dripping, seeping into your veins. Almond eyes once held and loved me, now blurred in morphine glaze. I squirm each time you wince. I know the torment, the agony each second holds for you, and I want to explode with rage. Lord, I implore you to take me. Give me her pain. Inflict this diabolical suffering, this serial slaughter of my beloved upon this young, this your willing child. Please, please, release her. Hours hang like walrus tusks from Big Ben. Seconds scream, flesh turns black, and my lack is palpable. It's Christmas, and the manger you made for me lies in solitary confinement under our undecorated tree on the black and white and brown shag carpet. And I'm not there. I'm here by your side, willing to die for your relief. And I die inside, and I cannot hide as I bide your agony. How sacred to love, to offer most holy gift of life for the beloved, and not ever be able to eliminate or even relieve one iota of their torture. No words. End poem.
Great read. Okay, down. And what a powerful write from Liquid Mind Forever, to be dealing with somebody who's, it sounds like maybe dealing with frostbite, like was left outside, or maybe even, I'm not sure, but that's the impression that I get, is like a parent or a loved one at the very least. Who was left out, who in the cold and got stuck. But it's maybe not even that. You know, just for some reason this person is dying. And the hospital bed is painted as so unfriendly, you know, lying on your back against cold stainless steel, bed rails with liquid sleep dripping into your veins. It's just like morphine on a cold, hard hospital bed, while it's equally cold and hard outside, and to watch them suffer in this horrible pain and not be able to do anything about it, to want so badly to shoulder some of that for a parent, I'm assuming, based on some of this language, upon this your willing child and, arms that once held me. I really liked some of the language in here. The hours hang like walrus tusks from Big Ben, just these looming giants. Like, it's almost like a new and better way to say, like, elephants in the room, because, they're... walrus tusks are so just obvious, and just hanging there. I really enjoyed the imagery of that. And I think this does a fantastic job of embracing that quote, about wanting to, give something they have. You can't give them, but you want them to have it. And this would be, relief, wanting them to have peace and just not be able to ease that suffering. There was one piece in here, too, that had on the, in part five, that third stanza has such great, like, internal rhyme and repetitive sounds in it that I think really stresses that, the angst of not being able to do anything, that the angry helplessness, you know, I'm here by your side, willing to die for your relief, and I die inside, and I cannot hide as I bide your agony. All of those those hard eye noises, I think do a really good job of emphasizing that feeling. I really enjoyed this piece. I thought it was very emotionally effective and heartfelt, and you could really get a sense of the pain and how this holiday is not, at least this year and probably residually for some time, you know, not the warm comfort that a lot of people expect from the holiday, which is, I think, more common than a lot of people acknowledge. You know, it's hard, I think. The hard pill to swallow sometimes that other people are happy and experiencing joy when you're not. And I think it's more common than the world gives on because it's almost taboo to talk about it. So I really enjoyed this. I thought this was a great take on the prompt, and I thought it was very relatable. Like, you could feel the pain. So, wonderful job. Viviana, what did you think?
I think that the way she describes the hospital bed is so true and so powerful. It really brings you into that moment, the cold stainless steel bed rails and the liquid sleep, that dripping of the medicine that's the only reason you can sleep in the pain. And thinking about the ice outside and comparing it to that cold stainless steel, I mean, it's extra cold steel when it's cold out. Sometimes if it's really, really hot, that steel can be almost comforting, even though it's kind of a strange thing to have in your bed. But it's in the winter, that's just like, it's truly a cold cage. I like the way she wrote dripping. She did it in such a way that it's like one letter per line, how do you even say that, Babbler? It's physically looks like it's dripping as it goes into the vein.
The structure.
Yes, the structure of it. I think there's a term for when it does that, when it looks like it is, but I can't remember that term. I gotta look that up because it happens quite a bit. And that part about the eyes really struck me as well. Almond eyes once held and loved me, now blurred in morphine glaze. And there is something about that morphine glaze that's so disconcerting, just knowing that they don't really fully see you and they may not even know who you are, and it's just they're not themselves. And it's one thing if that's a temporary thing and you know, like, they're going to be better after, and it's unnerving, but it's going to be okay. But if they're near the end of their life, and it's like, it sort of feels like they're already gone when they have that glazed over look. So that can be really scary. And then that kind of sympathy pain, I squirm each time you wince. That uncomfortable feeling of knowing someone else is so uncomfortable that you feel like you need to do something. And there's that, like, involuntary movement on your part because it's like you want to be able to help, and there's that helplessness of not being able to. So I think that this really does take the quote further. It's not just about not being able to buy something for someone. It's not being able to relieve their pain. And I think you're right, Babbler. People don't always say when a holiday is hard for them, and it can really be. You know, I kind of hate when people ask, like, what are you doing for the holidays? And I'm like, nothing. It's just like, are you ready for Christmas? There's no getting ready to do. I don't know. There's a grumpiness in me, and I don't even have something horrible like this happening where someone is really ill or dying. So I can definitely see that people would struggle knowing that, like, this is supposed to be a happy time, and there's this pressure to be, like, having the best time when you're really not. I think she captured that very well.
Yeah, I for years I dealt with that negativity of Christmas. You know, for me especially as a kid, it was really hard because we didn't have anything. And then it was kind of punctuated by the fact that my father had passed away, you know, on December 15th. So it was like always just kind of looming, you know, like we don't have anything. And the reason why is just very, you know, fresh at that particular time of year. So I relate to it quite a bit. I thought this was really wonderfully done. What's up next?
Yes. Now we have an audio from G.A. Grimm. So I'm just going to load that up. Here we go.
My Christmas Story by G.A. Grimm. I was to be a hero. When I left the state of Magnolias long ago, it was with purpose, not just to escape the neglect and squalor. Secretly, I dreamed, held close and clenched tight, in case some capricious god was watching and denied me on some whim. I was going to do something that you cannot provide, but all I sent back was money. Having a strained relationship was not helped by the many miles that now separated us. Yet surprisingly, I found this bothered me little. I would hear from you on holidays or when you needed something. One always happened more often than the other, which honestly was not surprising. Many years later, filled mostly with good memories, I find myself shocked, not unlike my first time experiencing winter here in the Buckeye State, that you are now in a hospital, having waited a day after a stroke to go, even though you knew what it meant to wait, and things are not looking good. This upset me. Truthfully, not just because of you, but because of what it meant for those who stayed by you, the further burden placed upon them by your continued questionable decisions. Maybe it's the antidepressants that stopped me from feeling bad, but I fear that just like outside where I now live, the first place that felt like home, I have grown cold. I was to be your hero, but perhaps I am the villain.
Thank you so much for the SoundCloud, G.A. Grimm. I love hearing SoundCloud. I think it just adds so much to the piece. To hear it in the author's voice. So I always encourage it. So thank you for this write and the SoundCloud with it. This is another, like, just really kind of gray but heartfelt write about struggles at Christmas, you know, about a complicated relationship with a parent. You know, when leaving the area to escape, you know, a shitty childhood, neglect and squalor, and to dream that you'll be able one day to provide for your family, and to become this adult that is somehow managing to, you know, piece together a decent life, then be pulled back into this scenario by an irresponsible parent who had a stroke and waited to call and to reburden everyone with their poor choices again. I relate to this probably a little too much. You know, it reminds me a lot of my own childhood in a lot of ways. So last week, I took my mom to the ER because she wasn't feeling well, and she'd been not feeling well for a long time. So I finally took her into the ER, and the end of the day, it was discovered she had continued to take a medication that she had an allergic reaction to on the first day that she took it, and I told her to stop taking it on that first day, and she said that she would, but apparently she didn't. You know, she called me all incoherent, not making any sense. I had to leave work and go and pick her up, and it's just awkward because I relate so much to this. Like, I want to be there. I want to help. I want to be supportive. I want to be, like, that good child. But sometimes it's hard to care when it's like, why do I care so much when sometimes I feel like you just don't give a shit about me? And you don't think about anyone other than yourself or how your actions affect anyone other than yourself. And then worse, to take that thought process again, step forward and be like, well, this bitterness, you know, what does that say about me? You know, to feel that way, does that make me heartless? So I really relate on a lot of levels, especially with just recent events in my family. And, like, I love some of the examples, you know, that they give. The way that it's phrased, you know, to leave, you know, this area, you know, to only be called when you need something. You know, not because they want to say hello, not because they just wonder what you're doing, but because there's always some reason that they call. There's always some thing or expectation. And just, I don't know, I feel the burden of this piece because it reflects a lot of my own, you know, shared experience, I think, with at least the narrator, if it's not just, you know, a story. So I don't know. I struggle with this one a little bit emotionally because it's like I could have written 90% of it. Especially when, like, my alcoholic stepdad had a stroke when I was 16, and I was the one who found him. So I just, that hardening of the heart, and yet still having this soft center and questioning what it means about you, you know, I was to be your hero, but perhaps I'm the villain, just because you don't care anymore. But it's not, and I think anybody from the outside would say, no, I don't think that makes you hardened or callous. I think, you know, at some point you have to start protecting yourself when you realize the other person is just constantly inflicting wounds, and that doesn't make you a bad person. So I really enjoyed this write. I thought it was really good. It's dark, it's powerful. For me, it feels like, you know, wanting to give somebody something but not being able to because they won't let you. So I think this is really well done. Amaziana, what did you think?
Well, I think thank you, first of all, for sharing your comment. And I'm sorry that both you and G.A. Grimm have had such a difficult family relationship where this happens. But I think that he does such a great job of describing it and, you know, making it relatable to even to people who haven't experienced it. And I do think it's a personal right, because in the AN it says, something I will never say to the one it's for, mercy or cowardice, I know not. Whether it's being nice or being afraid to not tell the person that this is how they're feeling. I think that the way that it's described here, I dreamed held close, clenched tight, in case some capricious god was watching and denied me of some whim I was going to do something that you could not. It's like the idea of planning to move away and feeling badly about it, like you can't even like admit to yourself that you want it, Because what if you think it and then it's taken away from you? It's like you can't even allow yourself to believe it until it's happening, that you escape. And then all I sent back was money, is the idea of, you know, not going back and making things better, but just sort of being like, here, have this, fix it yourself, because you can't bear to be back yourself, and there's really doesn't seem like there's anything you can do other than send the money, and then it's not used well, and that painfulness of only being contacted when they want something, I mean, I've definitely witnessed that, thankfully not with my own family, but with my in-laws, and that just, it's really sad to see that it doesn't work, because when you have a strong relationship, being long distance is very different than if you don't have that relationship foundation to start. This is really devastating, and I think well written. Thank you, GA, for writing this and sharing it, and also thank you for doing the audio. I love your audios. And that ending, I should be your hero, perhaps I'm the villain. I really don't think you're the villain. I get the thing about antidepressants making you feel cold, because I know I'm on them as well, and I find I don't have necessarily the big reactions that I feel like I should sometimes, because I'm so used to, like, getting over-the-top emotional about other people's problems, that now if I'm, like, not a complete mess when I hear something sad, I'm like, oh no, I've become heartless. But it's not that I don't care. And you're just learning to set your boundaries and not go so deep into it. So you're not the villain.
I like how we're like emotional polar opposites of each other. Like, you know, get over emotional about other people's business. And I'm always sitting here telling myself, like, I should probably care. Like, the fact that I don't care, like, I'm like, I get rationally why I should care, but I don't.
Like, I don't nearly as much as I used to. I don't as much as I used to. I used to, like, over the top be, like, emotionally exhausted at all times because I was so upset by even, like, strangers who I see suffering. And my therapist was like, you need to realize you have enough of your own shit. Stop taking in everyone else's pain. She was like, enough of this. We're not going to do it anymore. So now I, like, consciously I'm like, this is not my problem. And then I'm thinking in my head, I'm such a bitch. Why would I think that? Like, I have to tell myself, like, don't freak out about it.
Well, for me, it's more like, wow, that's pretty terrible. I'm like, I should probably feel bad. I'm like, why don't I feel bad? I'm like, well, I'm kind of a callous asshole. Usually how my thinking goes. I've gotten better over the years, but definitely as a teenager, do not come to me for empathy. You're gonna get blank stares. And like I said, rationally I understood that I should care, but like emotionally. And even today, I'm not, like, I don't think I'm as emotionally involved as most people. Like, I think it's been, like, well over a year since I've actually cried. I don't know why. That's just how I am. That's kind of just an odd thing about me. And I'm not saying I don't care. Like, I do care, but I just don't feel it emotionally like I can tell that other people do, if that makes sense. So it's almost, like, rationally.
Yeah, I feel it so emotionally that it's like a physical reaction. Like when you said you haven't cried in a year, I picture like there's this meme of like this weird little puppet monkey guy where his eyes like look like suspicious, and I would be posed like this is me right now because I'm like I totally cried today. But so in a way, we are kind of opposites like that.
In the middle, we have like a well. Emotionally regulated person, right?
Yeah. I don't even know what that looks like.
To be fair, I don't think I've
anyway.
Met one either.
There might not really be. Just nothing. I was watching this show earlier. It was like Fleischman is in trouble, and the wife has postpartum depression, and she's like, I don't need a therapist. I'm not sad. I'm just crazy. And he was like, you know, crazy is kind of their thing. it could still be good. Maybe you should go. And she's like, I said I'm not sad. And he was like, no. Okay. But just the way he was like, crazy is kind of their thing. I don't know. This is, anyway, I am not mocking crazy people. I am one myself. So, anyway, let's see what Bill Schiller had to say about our contest. Would you read that one for us, Babbler?
Absolutely. I'm playing this weird game today, and I've been playing it all day, and I don't know why, of where is my mouse cursor? I keep rolling it around all over the screen and somehow not I don't know why. All right, this is A Christmas Memory by Bill Schiller. It goes like this. Like old grandpa learning, children won't call. I was crushed by what I saw. On day after Christmas, I found my letter to Santa crumpled in garbage. I learned Easter bunnies don't jump. Tooth fairy money is only mirage. I wept for disillusion and parent-prompted confusion, believing absence of those creatures was so utterly tragic. Christmas is still merry, but lost much magic. End poem.
Great read, Babbler. And I think this is a write that really captures that moment in childhood. I know for me, I found out about all the things at once, and I think that a lot of people do, because once they realize that one thing is make-believe, then what about everything else that you believed? And you start to question everything. So that one crumpled letter from Santa could just, you know, be that factor where all the dominoes fall, and you learn about the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy and all of those things. And it feels like a tragedy at the time, like you're losing figures in your life who really matter to you. But, you know, it doesn't really destroy the holiday, but it takes away the magic of it. So you still, you know, I think you get a better appreciation for the people who do the things. Like, I definitely was like, mom and dad bought this, and because we did not have a lot of money, you know, I saw that it was like a big deal that they were not even taking credit for getting the things that they did do. And I was always proud that the Easter Bunny loved me the most, because I had like the coolest Easter Bunny setups in out of my friends. I always had like really cool Easter stuff, and then I was like, oh, like mom did that. And then, I don't know, it takes on a different kind of magic, but it does lose the like fantasy magic. And what I find really interesting about this poem is the first line, like old grandpa learning children won't call. And isn't that a sad line that as the older person, you can also lose that Christmas magic because you thought that there was that connection there that maybe there isn't, and you're not getting that where the younger generation is paying attention to you if you're not there, you know, being the Santa. Now that they've realized that the magic is gone for them, they don't connect with you as the elder. So that's that line in particular really shapes the whole poem for me. It's the two ends of losing the magic of the holiday.
I agree with you. That opening line in particular is very dark. like, just, you know, the disappointment, you know, the gut punch of it. I think it really sets it to be, like, a darker right because of that opening. You know, how lonely and isolating that realization is, that, you know, sitting by the phone, no one's going to call you. You know, depressing. But, you know, I also look at, you know, the loss of the Christmas magic, making you realize that, oh, there's also no Easter Bunny, and there's no Tooth Fairy, and all of those things are lies. You know, and it almost comes jointed in some ways with the realization that your parents will lie to you, and that not everything that they've said is true, which is its own kind of gut punch, you know, as well. I didn't go through this like this when I was a child. I never believed in Santa. There's a video of me as a very small child calling it Mommy Claus. I don't know why. I didn't really buy into it. But I do remember the moment, like, that I stopped believing in fairies, because it's not even that I stopped. It's I realized I didn't believe in fairies, that I was pretending that fairies existed, which means that I didn't believe they existed, which meant that they weren't real and I would never think they were real. And that, like, utterly broke me when I was, like, 4. Like, I was so just disappointed in the fact that I didn't believe they were real. And they'd never be real for me again. Epiphanies are strange like that. You know, but like you were saying, like, when you realize, too, how much work goes into parents doing these things to keep this magic alive and to give so much of themselves without credit, I think that is its own kind of magic in a way. But it is also problematic. You know, when kids do believe in Santa and they do believe in the Tooth Fairy and they do believe in the Easter Bunny, then the poor kids get to wonder, why doesn't Santa like me? Why am I such a bad kid? Like, why don't I get good money from the Tooth Fairy? Why is my Easter basket crappy? You know, and that can be equally hard. You know, if you believe in Santa Claus and you stumble up at school after Christmas and all of your friends and schoolmates got these awesome, really cool prizes, or presents, sorry, not prizes, and you got nothing, or something really small, or something really simple, you know, it raises a lot of questions about, like, self-worth that I think can be harmful sometimes. So, I don't know, it's careful balance. You know, traditions are traditions, and I'm not going to tell anybody, oh, God, what you're doing is so wrong and bad, but, you know, maybe consider some of the repercussions. You know, it's not that you can't buy your kids Christmas presents, but maybe don't, like, go crazy if you're going to make them believe in Santa. You know, just, I don't know. You know, it's just the way it is. Life isn't fair, and some learn that sooner than others. But I really enjoyed the write. I think it was very effective. It was filled with a lot of disappointment, which, as hard as it is to bear, you know, it's a thing. And sometimes that's just how the holidays feel for some people. So I thought this was a great write. Thank you, Bill.
For our next poem, we have another audio. This is Fully Content by Heartthrob.
This is Heartthrob the Poet, coming to you with my latest piece, Fully Content. Truly hope you like it. It's immaterial to go without, when we came here with nothing. What this season's all about is a love more than anything. To not produce what someone wants may be a hard thing to bear. And most importantly is love. There's no price for it to share. Yet it came at a cost, but not for any of us. On an old rugged cross, with hope our Lord did trust. To do the will of his Father, who promises to be our God, our all in all, should make thy heart sing. to want for nothing is a gift. Therefore, find all you ever need. Just abide in Him as He rests in thee. Once again, this is Hawthorne the Poet, coming to you live, bidding you peace and blessings during this holiday season. Merry Christmas. God bless.
Great audio. Thank you so much for sharing that. I love that there was the music in the background and everything. It was very nice, nicely put together. For me, the part that touched me was about how the most important thing to give is love, and there's no price to share it. And that even if you can't afford to give someone presents, you know, you by being there for them, can be giving to them. So I liked that message a lot. I'm not a very religious person myself, but I like that he put his faith into it because, you know, this is a religious-based holiday, and I think that it was beautifully worded.
I also thought that this was really well done. Christmas poem. It almost had that I can't think of the right word for it, but the same feeling as like Holy Night, that kind of quiet Christmas feeling. You know, it's immaterial to go without. You know, just remember that it's okay to not get things for Christmas. It doesn't have to be about presents. And that, you know, as long as you have love, you know, it's a better holiday. But even that in itself carries weight, you know, because people, when you say that, expect, like, oh, surrounded by family, which isn't possible for everyone. Some people don't have family. Some people are separated from their family. You know, so even that can be, like, a hard weight. So in this way, I think that putting it into this religious subtext of, you know, being able to just even have that just between, you know, a love of, in a religion, you know, if you believe in God and you love God and you believe that God loves you, that can be enough, you know, to get you through Christmas. There's some good pieces tucked in here, though, you know, it not being about materialism, you know, about, you know, just having what you need, you know, to want for nothing is a gift, which is really true. If you have food, if you have a place to sleep, if you have, you know, all of your real basic needs met, be thankful for that. You know, not everyone does. It's a huge gift. Someone I know was recently faced a huge unexpected medical bill that had like a $950 upfront mandatory payment. And so she suddenly had absolutely no money to buy her kids gifts. She was very upset. She was crying. And, you know, I was trying to cheer her up, and I was just like, you know, on the bright side, you were able to pay the medical bill. And on the bright side, you know, your child was able to get the surgery they needed. And you have a house, and you have warm water, and you have food. And all of those are gifts, you know. Like, if you want to get cheesy about it, you can run around on Christmas Eve and stick bows on all of those things. I'm like, but, you know, your children are old enough, your children are teenagers, that they should understand. You know, and I realize that can be hard, especially if you've never had a Christmas that hard. You know, those were normal for me growing up. You know, there was a year that all I got for Christmas was donated canned goods from a food bank. So, you know, thankfulness looks like different things. Solemn, that's the word I was looking for. This has a very solemn feel to it. So I thought this was beautifully done. It's very, very quiet and serene and heartfelt. Thought it was wonderfully done. So thank you, Heartthrob. Where are we off to next?
Next, we have one called A Christmas Memory by Charlie Bottle. They stood in the bakery, two boys, 7 years old, neighbors. Glazed cakes in glass cabinets stared back at excited faces. One was running errands for bread. The other was keeping him company. In seriousness, one said to the other, "If I had money, I would buy you that cake." The one with the chocolate icing and red, white, and green lettering that said Merry Christmas. The other said, "If I had money, I would buy you all the cupcakes with silver balls and sprinkles." The baker smiled and asked, "What can I get you, boys?" "A loaf of sliced bread, please," one replied. And the other said, "I am just here because I am his friend." He handed the boy a loaf of bread in brown paper. As they waited for their change, the baker took two cupcakes and wrapped them in tissues. He gave it to them with the change and said, "Merry Christmas." They wished and thanked him, their faces lit with happiness. They mounted their bicycles and rode away, and he heard the distant voices say, "This bakery will always be my favorite from today." It was not the sweetness of the soft cake I remember. It was the gentle sweetness of the gesture I won't forget, for it was a Christmas memory iced with sprinkles. End poem.
I really liked this. You know, it was its own little Christmas memory, and it felt Norman Rockwell-esque in its styling. You know, standing with a friend and talking about all of the things you would get for each other if you could, and then to be gifted yourself with a treat. I particularly liked those closing two lines. It was the gentle sweetness of the gesture I won't forget, for it was a Christmas memory iced with sprinkles. You know, the way it kind of takes the double meaning of sweetness and ice, and I think it's well done. But it has that kind of classic nostalgia to it, and it makes, at least for me think of similar times in my life, although I was a bit darker as a child. I remember standing on a bridge with a really good friend of mine, and looking at the traffic going below, and I told her, like, if it had to be me or you jumping off this bridge, I would jump for you every time. Which, like I said, much darker. I was a much darker child.
I was your ride and die friend, though. I respect that.
Yeah, I was like maybe, I want to say I was maybe like 10. I want to say it was like fourth or fifth grade. You know, and she just seemed very shocked that I would say that. And she was like, "Oh, I'd never let you jump." But I'm like, "Right, but if it had to be you or me, I'd jump in every time." But it just makes me think of that. But in a much softer and warmer of context, you know. So, and I like that they don't, like, steal the cupcakes or sneak the cupcakes or use the bread money to buy stuff that they were not approved to purchase. You know, so. And these are the little bits of kindness that really do sometimes stick with people. So, I really enjoyed this. I thought this was a nice classic piece that really tied in well to the original write. If you were to read it, it has a very similar overall feeling. So, but here captured in much, much fewer words. Well done, right, Charlie Bottle. I enjoyed it.
I liked that he used dialogue, so you can have the perspective of the boys and hear that they want to do things for each other. Like, that is just adorable. And it's not like they're like, "Oh, I wish I had money so I could have that one." The fact that they wanted money to give to each other is just so sweet. And then him giving them the gift also benefits his business because it's the best bakery from now on. And, you know, those little things can change the way that people see your stuff, and then they'll always end up getting their bread there. We were just doing this training session not long ago about customer service, and I'm for a nonprofit, so, like, we're not trying to make money anyway, but it's just the idea of, like, making people always leave happy. And one of those videos we had to watch in the training session was this, like, old-school diner thing, and the guy was saying, if a customer asks for a pickle, don't worry about how much that would cost or figure it out. He's like, just give them a pickle. And he's like, make them happy. So whenever we were doing our thing and we were talking about, like, possibly having to break a little rule to get someone something, the trainer guy would go, give them the pickle. And so now whenever we do something and it's, like, above and beyond and we're like, oh, I'm totally going to get in trouble for doing this, I'm just like, so I gave him a pickle, and the boss is like, good. like, pickle is our joke. And this just feels like, this guy gave them a pickle in metaphoric terms because now they will always consider that, like, a happy place and want to support it again. So, yeah, I'm just kind of lost in the pickleness of it all in a good way.
Way to take a heartfelt memory and make it about consumer and not giving.
See? I'm a nonprofit.
How to You're profit right. from Christmas memory. No, I'm kidding. Don't give them a cupcake because it's heartwarming and kind. Do it so they'll patronize your bakery. No.
No. Okay, you're right. I totally destroyed it, but it was a beautiful poem. No, it'll be they grow up, and they'll do that for someone because they'll remember how special it was for them. There. Is that better? Yeah.
Much.
So that was a... We're going to pretend I didn't just butcher that. Okay, so prompt two. And when that happens, I know it, a message saying so merely confirms a piece of news some secret vein had already received, severing me from an irreplaceable part of myself, letting it loose like a kite on a broken string. That is why, walking across the school campus on this particular December morning, I keep searching the sky, as if I expected to see, rather like hearts, a lost pair of kites hurrying towards heaven. Truman Capote, A Christmas Memory. So that is what the next few poems are to. And Babbler, I'm going to put one up for you by Opti.
This is Santa and Me by Opti. I got a banjo for Christmas when I was 2. Wonderful. I wanted a gun, I think. I'm not sure. I was only 2. I got a can of beans when I was 3. That's true. When I was 5, Santa was not alive. They said not to fear. His son would be here next year. At 6, 7, and 8, Santa was late. But not to fear. He'd be here. Just wait. At 17, they told me he did not exist. No wonder I'm fucked up. End poem.
Excellent read. I loved your emphasis at the end there. well, I mean, this kind of sounds like what you were saying earlier, the canned food as the gift. Interesting, the idea of, you know, saying that, like, there'll be a new generation of Santa coming, and then, you know, he was late because he was just a little kid during that time, and then, oh, look, he's not real. This is done with humor, but has sad undertones because I think people really do experience it. But Opti did it in a fun way. What did you think, Babbler?
Yeah, I liked the tongue-in-cheekness to this, but also the darkness of it. Things are a little weird, too, which I found interesting. You know, the banjo. Banjos aren't particularly cheap and not appropriate for a two-year-old. Maybe it was a play banjo or a toy, but then to think that the kid wanted a gun. Wow, I'm glad I got the banjo. And then to go from that to a tin of beans. Like, what happened between 2 and 3, that really just dramatically decreased the Christmas budget there? And then to bullshit your kid through, 5, 6, 7, 8. Worse is to tell your a 5-year-old that Santa's dead. Like, if you don't have money for Christmas, that's one thing. But to tell your 5-year-old who believes in Santa that he's dead is really, really pretty dark. I think it says a lot about the parents here. And then to just say that 6, 7, 8, he's late. To me, that says that, they're buying stuff out of the Christmas discount bin between Christmas and New Year's. Like, oh no, we got you something. It's just a little late because it was waiting until stuff was on sale, and then at 17, you're saying, like, there is no Santa, which to me, too, 17 seems really late to come to the epiphany that Santa is not real. Was this the only thing your parents were lying to you about? I thought you'd put it together before then. But it does kind of highlight what I was talking about earlier. Imagine being a kid in school and going to school and all these kids are like, oh, Santa got me this. And they're like, my parents said Santa's dead, or he's always late to my house, or I always get crappy gifts, it sheds light on, what some of the Santa folklore can be kind of harmful in some ways, it's fun until it's showing, putting classism, really, under a bright light. But, yeah, no wonder I'm fucked up. Yeah, your parents are buying you musical instruments, telling you Santa is dead. Yeah, there's a lot there. I don't think it's necessarily the Santa stories that are why you would be messed up as a narrator here, so much as your parents seem to make some questionable choices throughout. It's an interesting mix, I think, of serious and humor. I enjoyed it overall, though. Thank you. Opti for the ride.
And I'm really now getting vibes of my step-grandpa. So I don't know about step-grandpa, but my grandma in her later years dated a man who was totally a swindler and, was always had, a house full of vacuums or something that he was, stealing. I don't know. Or selling, in quotation marks. I just, all of these things connect with him. He has a banjo. He had the gun. He had, a million canned food things because he thought it was the apocalypse. Oh, it's Guy. And he totally would force you to shop after Christmas because you weren't going to waste money on things before. So, yeah, I feel like I know this guy's parents.
At least they didn't get him the gun, okay?
This is true. This is true. I'm like, are they trying to, establish, a hillbilly stereotype? And then I'm like, oh, wait, that's my family.
They did start off with a banjo, okay?
Right? Oh, I remember that banjo well. Yep. Oh, my goodness. People are learning about us.
Stay out of
if they're listeners of our show, they know we're complicated.
One way to phrase it.
Right? It's a positive note.
The last line of that last poem might also help.
Yeah, that could also describe us. That's fair. But our next poet gave us an audio, So let's celebrate that.
Velvet roses awaken unraveled in the attic, her eyes tinted. Through November's calico sun, spring's dandelion dust, summer's excitement, sugarcane fishing holes. Over crystals under glass, pecans windfall of frosted scraps, eyes exacting, tessellated, tallow burns wakened wick, float away colored night's candlelight, thunderclaps collapse, dusk turns apple jelly and peach preserves, a small word magnifies then slips back. Rusty pine burrs, scented briars catch at our clothes, copper stacked in oil glows, whiskey spoons and vanillas sweeten air, moss drifts by the river's edge, ginger puffs of chimney smoke, burlap logs crumbling, coldness of chicory thorns, our steps slow down, penny postcards amongst afternoon scrapbooks, dust, muddy cloud, hidden routes of rose-colored symmetry, I felt two hands in the evening air that won't stop, palms trying for perfection of balance, laughter trapped as mercury plummets, Irish picks up a pen, inked in blue daiquiri. This quilt of resilience has its own friction, flapjacks, harmony glitz and honeycomb, cordially pulling me back. Blowing, running, plunging through hand-tied stems, kites unreal, twitching at the string, discovering whisper's tone, citron's cosmetic picture of hummingbirds, faraway cherries, tingling, May buds, chill in July, echoes carried on tides, full-blown sails, severing a kite's broken string, light bends searching December's seafoam sky, chimes awaiting the northbound train, rivulet's pebbles floating through nostalgia's frame, hands subtract pennies tossed in copper's windowpane. A nightingale sings an octave, faith becomes an echo, leather-bound gingerly, blackberries picked in wooden bowls, mirrors exposure of trees and light, of paper tinged a warm hue, memories upstream, scenes shot in clouds, unconscious rain, a locket click emerged, pensively edged leaflets, that's how it is in books, interplay, impressionist splashed watercolors, that's how it is in childhood, playful reserved, crayon parchments and books are like childhood, movement rendered portraiture, flecked by a distant past, one is mine, another is yours, one stock canvas, plastered acrylic, yet another floats downstream. Rediscovery, wistfully, illustrative. Twilight descends, a miracle, the breath of a friend. Seeing you, end poem.
I really enjoyed this piece. And thank you, Xylophone, for the SoundCloud. Really appreciate it. It gave a wonderful cadence to this piece. There's so much imagery in this piece. It paints such a picture, you know. Starting out, you know, with all these different seasons and all these different nostalgic moments, you know. Velvet roses awaken unraveled in the attic. You know, to me that says, you know, old memories that are kind of falling apart, that are a little bit in shambles, but were still saved because they meant something, you know, in November, like a late season, having collected all of these different, you know, the memories themselves of different seasons, having been up there for some time, you know, and then looking just at all these different moments, you know, the conned windfall of frosted scraps, eyes exacting tessellated, tallow burns wakened wick, float away colored night's candlelight, just the way firelight glitters in the eyes. I love the way that it was phrased here, you know, watching a candle and you can just see the flames kind of dancing, the way thunderclaps feels, you know, as the sky turns the color of jellies. There's just wonderful tie-ins that are unexpected and yet still visualizable. You know, I can see that turn in sky, but I never would have looked at it and thought apple jelly and peach preserves. You know, I would have been like, oh, it's golden and pink, you know. But it's such a much more poetic and visually pleasing way to describe it. And then to go through more of these seasons and more of these memories and the different senses all tied in, you know, the vanilla sweetened air and moths on a river's edge, ginger puffs of chimney smoke. You know, it almost reminds me a little bit of Hansel and Gretel and the gingerbread house, but it also makes me think of trying to burn wet wood. you know, burlap logs rumbling. I think of rotten wood, you know, wood that's just completely dry rotted, that crumbles when you touch it. And I just thought that was such a wonderful description to describe them as burlap. There were so many in here that I really just enjoyed visually. And then to get to the end, you know, and describe it as, you know, this is what childhood is like. It's impressionist splashed watercolors. That's how it is in childhood. And isn't it? You know, I don't remember every single day of being a kid. Absolutely not. There are a few, I think, rare cases of people who remember every single moment and day of their lives. I am not one of those. I kind of wonder, too, if that's like both a blessing and a curse. I don't think I'd want to remember every single day of my life. But you get the impressions. You get the tidbits that kind of color how you feel about your childhood. You know, the key moments, the things that stick with you. And that's really kind of what your past is painted like. You know, playful, reserved, crayon parchments and books are like childhood. You know, just these little scribbles and scraps that kind of fall apart. You know, movement-rendered portraits, which is always an interesting concept, you know, to try to draw something as it moves, draw something as it changes, to try to capture, you know, a moment in an image is just about impossible. Like, I can't think of the name of the photographer. There's an artist who does the photography who captured movement in photographs. Like, he took tons of Polaroids and images and arranged them together so that even though it's a still moment, you can still see the movement because he took the pictures as things move, you know, so like people can be in numerous places in a scene. It's really fascinating. I'm sorry, I remember the name of the artist right now, but I can't. Fascinating work, but it makes me think of that. And to be like, and I have my painting and you have yours, you know, and mine looks like this, but someone else's might look like this, you know, and yet here we are again, you know, twilight descends a miracle, the breath of a friend seeing you, you know, just to come together again, to have all these interwoven moments that put together entirely different paintings and maybe not even co-remember the same moments, but to have touched each other's lives so many times. I think it's really beautiful. It is nostalgic, and I think it's wonderfully emotive. You can really feel a lot of the different metaphors that were painted together to kind of give, you know, the cliff notes of a childhood here that's more about feeling than facts. You know, it's more about how phrases and colors and scents and descriptions elicit a feeling or an atmosphere than it does like actually trying to physically visualize what you're describing. So I thought this was beautifully done, beautifully done. So thank you, the Xylophonic Blues, for this submission. I really loved this piece. Athena, your thoughts?
I loved it. I mean, you covered a lot of what I thought about it. The part that I liked the best was impressionist splash watercolors, that's how it is in childhood. And on the one hand, it's like you said, it's, you know, you remember it in that way. But I think also it's sometimes it's experienced in that way where you're a kid, when you're a kid, you don't totally understand everything that's going on. So you get kind of like the watercolor version of things where it's beauty in its blurriness because, like, the holidays are just like, you know, this magicalness. There's light and food and all the things, and you don't see the details. Whereas when you're an adult, it's more like realism instead of impressionist, where you can see the strain in the mother's eyes as she hasn't slept because she was up wrapping presents all night, or, you know, notice how much work is going into the stuff in the kitchen, and you see all the little details that make it a little bit less magical. Whereas when you're a kid and you have that watercolor view of things, it all just kind of blends together in this beauty. I don't know, that's what I was thinking about when I read that part. And like you pointed out, there's so many different senses that are engaged. There's the smells are really emphasized, and like vanilla sweetened air, the ginger puffs of the smoke, everything's given really cool descriptions. I like the food imagery that was used to describe the nature, like you said. Where is it now? Darn, I can't find it. There was a really cool description about something that... also, there's the tactileness of the briars and burrs that catch in the clothes. And then later on, there's something similar to that where it's that prickliness and everything getting stuck together. And something about that is just a very tactile, realistic feeling. It's one that you can't, like, forget that feeling of having those things stuck to you. It's just memorable. I found it interesting that a pen was inked in blue daiquiri. Like, is daiquiri a thing other than the drinks? It probably is. I just think of daiquiri as, like, the slushy drink. I don't know, but I liked that. Blue daiquiri. It's a cool detail.
Yeah, I'm not wonderful really sure if it is or not.
I want to look it up now because I've always just thought of it as a drink, and I like the drink.
Yeah, I don't know. I did remember the name of the photographer that I was thinking of, David Hockney. David Hockney. Kind of reminds me of it.
It had to be a drink. I'm looking at Blue Daiquiri, and there's only drinks coming up. So they used the drink to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very creative.
I like it.
Very creative and wonderful tie-ins to things that you wouldn't necessarily put together. I loved it.
I agree. Okay. Our next poem is by Poet Dane. I believe it's my turn to read. Oh, I can get lost in it sometimes because that was an audio one. But I'm going to read it anyway. So here we go.
Oh, boy.
Fireworks by Poet Dane. Fireworks illuminated the midnight sky. The new year was here, bristling with winter's chill, electrifying our senses, crystallizing the past. Fireworks. The final holiday gift, serenading our senses, expressing our joy, friendly, fiery stars we could call our own. Fireworks, blue, red, gold, and white, exploding like dreams over our heads, sparks of luscious memories binding our souls. Fireworks, some went left, some went right, the division of our paths, churning with regret, our moments wasted. Fireworks, eulogizing our brief history, brighter, louder than a sonic boom, briefly entangled as lovers, sadly separating as friends. End poem.
Great read, Ephesiana. And I really enjoyed this piece. It was deeper than I thought it was at first glance, you know, where it's about enjoying the fireworks on New Year's, you know, just that last hurrah of the year or the welcoming of the new year or whatever context you want to put it in, where we, you know, light explosives into the air at midnight. You know, and talking about how it related to her relationship. You know, the first part, the fiery stars and the first sparks, you know, sparks of luscious memories binding our souls, you know, reflecting on this relationship and the fiery passion that used to be there. But then there was a split up, you know, the division of our paths, turning with her over moments wasted. And then a eulogy, you know, briefly entangled as lovers and sadly separating as friends. So these fireworks and the actions of the fireworks, which are completely relatable actions of fireworks, you know, have this subtext of this relationship and the way that they fizzle out, you know, the explosion and the goodbye. You know, I thought it was wonderfully done. You know, and the repetition of fireworks, I pictured, you know, like a firework being let off every time that the word came up, and I could almost hear it cracking in the sky. I think it was really well done in that context as well. So I could picture, you know, someone watching fireworks and thinking about all of the things that had happened perhaps over the course of the year that's represented in that moment. So I really liked it. I also loved the way that it ties into the quote, you know, about the kites, you know, being cut loose and let go. It ties into that well, nicely, you know, with that sense of loss, but not like super depressing necessarily, but, you know, like almost a freedom or a letting into the sky, kind of paired with loss. I think it did well to echo that emotion, the searching in the sky. So, well done. I enjoyed it. What were your thoughts, Viziana?
I enjoyed it too, and I agree. I was a little bit surprised in the way that it turned. I wasn't sure what to expect from it. I liked eulogizing our brief history, the idea of fireworks being that kind of celebration of what was when we were brighter, and then it's a goodbye in a sense. Every time it said fireworks, I pictured a different kind of firework. You know, there's the ones where it's like a big circle that kind of expands. And then when it was talking about someone left and someone right, I was picturing these, like, sizzly ones. I don't know what they're called. They're gold usually, and they're like, pshh, and go off to the side. Yeah, I'm making hand motions because you can totally see that.
But, hand motions, great for radio. Right there with facial expressions.
Right? Yeah, I pictured different kinds of firework, and I think that it really it brought things to life for me. But also, even though this is a really sad one, reminds me of this firework time. I think it was actually 4th of July things, and my parents live on the border of Michigan, so they're in Canada, but you can watch the fireworks from Michigan. So they were just like, we were on the boardwalk watching the American fireworks, and we were listening to the song If I Had $1 Million by the Bare Naked Ladies, and there's a part in it where it says, but not a real green dress, that's cruel, because earlier in the song it says, but not a real fur coat, that's cruel, and then later it's like, I buy you a green dress, but not a real green dress, that's cruel. And right when it said that, it had like this giant green firework. So then whenever there was another green firework, my mom and I would like burst out laughing hysterically. For some reason we thought it was like, oh no, it's a real green one. And like now whenever I see a green firework, I just like pee myself laughing because I'm weird. But anyway, this just made me think of that. So green fire.
funny.
Very
just
tangency.
Because you're weird.
Just because I'm weird. I get it from my mother. It just works so perfectly with the song, but not a real green dress. That's cruel. So it's not a real green fire. I don't know. Blame the bear.
Can I just say, that's a really interesting choice of song, you know, for watching fireworks, too. It's not typical.
Well, we weren't actually at the place where they were doing the fireworks, though, right? We were across the river. So, I don't know where we were. It must have been, like, the patio of a bar. Although I was too young, so I don't know. We were at the boardwalk. Just kind of tagging along. We always got double fireworks because we got the Canadian ones on the 1st, and then we got the American ones on the 4th.
Yeah. Mhm. So yeah, that's probably a more appropriate song, honestly, than like "Born in the USA," which is not a festive song if you listen to the lyrics. Which is why I was tackled when people use it for political purposes.
Yeah. People just cling on to like a couple of words and they don't pay attention to the whole context.
Yeah. Where are we?
We are now on prompt 3. It's fruitcake weather. So the first one is by Damn It Dave. If you will read that, please, Babbler.
All righty. This is Fruitcake Love by Damn It Dave. Folks tell me they hate fruitcake. That's a fact I highly doubt, because I just went to buy me one, and the stores have all sold out. I try to get one every year. Now I can only pray that Santa Claus will bring me one this year on Christmas Day. Of course, I have a backup plan. It pays to think ahead. A lemon cake sits in my fridge that I can eat instead. And
I mean, lemon is fruit, so.
I mean, it's a fruit cake.
Right? I thought this was fun. It had a cute little rhyme and flow to it. It has that great sense of humor of, you know, the people not liking it and yet it's all gone. It's not for sale because people don't like it. Although I have to say, I think what I had last week was considered fruitcake, but it was homemade and it was figgy pudding, and there's like I can't remember what it's called exactly. No, it's not figgy pudding. I don't know, but it had some kind of fruit things in it, and it was amazing. But it's totally different than that, like, hard as rock fruitcake that I think this is talking about. You know, that ridiculous one that's been, like, handed back and forth a million times. Because the one I had was freaking delicious. But this is different. This is the purchasable fruitcake, yuck. Yeah, I thought this was really funny and simple in a good way. I thought it matched the prompt. What did you think?
Yeah, I think the substitution of a lemon cake is a good idea. I would just call that your fruitcake. Because, yeah, store-bought fruitcake, I don't know what that is even, honestly. Like, the bright green and red dyed, I don't know what stuff peddling itself as fruit. And they're really not that good. I'm hoping you can't find any because they're just really not available and not because people are buying them out. I mean, I remember as a kid, it used to be a running joke that, like, you just re-gift them year after year because nobody eats them, which is funny in itself. But it's funny that you mentioned figgy pudding because it's actually what it brought to my mind because when I was a kid, I used to sing that song, We Want Some Figgy Pudding, and We Want It Right Now, all the time. And, like, I would just annoy the shit out of my mother with it. I was one of those annoying, repetitive kids, by the way. You know, I would say things over and over and over and over and over and over again and drive everyone around me mad. I also asked why way too many times. I was that annoying kid. But I asked for figgy pudding. I asked my mom to make figgy pudding for Christmas. And she kept saying, you don't want figgy pudding. And I kept insisting that I did want figgy pudding. And so she made figgy pudding, and she was absolutely right. I did not want figgy pudding. Because figgy pudding is not what most people think it is. It's a cake that is made with suet, which is raw beef and mutton fat. That also has, like, brown sugar, breadcrumbs, and, like, some dried fruit in it and some brandy. I think she probably left the brandy out because I was a child, but that is figgy pudding, which is not what I was expecting as a small child. I was expecting, I don't know why I was expecting this, but in my head it was like a tasty pudding, you know, like chocolate vanilla, but with figs and for some reason plums in it. And that is not what it is. There was level of disappointment involved in the figgy pudding event of my childhood. I think it pretty much put the end to me singing that song, though, so it had its own perks. But, yes, the backup plan here, the lemon cake, definitely go with it. This has excellent rhyme and flow and was just frankly fun to read. This is just a cute little happy piece about not being able to find a fruitcake. We'll see whether or not Santa gives you one. Maybe if you're bad. Well done.
Okay, the thing I had was not figgy pudding, that's for sure. It was sticky toffee pudding, and it was amazing. yeah, figgy pudding sounds messed up with the meat in there. Not for me. No. Mine was super yummy. It did have alcohol in it, but you cook off the alcohol, so it's not actually, like, alcoholic. Usually if there's alcohol in food, it's not enough to make you drunk.
Yeah, typically, no. No, but I just imagine that my mom probably would have taken it out in general just because we were pretty little.
Yeah. It's possible. you read that one. trying to keep track of who's who. This one is called Scandal by Weaver of Dreams. And it has a nice picture of some fruitcake, so be prepared. It's fine to be an avid fan of fruitcake. I would not wish to alter that at all. But if you can give me just a moment, I'd like to share a tale that I recall. It was a few weeks before Christmas, as Mrs. Jones bustled briskly about, ready to make her finest fruitcake to be the winner at the fete, no doubt. Complete with its secret ingredient, handed down infinitum. It is said this recipe was never written down. It was all safely stored in her head. This year was going to be different. Mrs. Jones had decided it was time to let her daughter know every part of what made this fruitcake sublime. She was bound to be shocked, of course. That was why there was no written list. If her neighbors knew that was in it, everyone would be totally put out. End poem.
Great read. Interesting text. I wonder what exactly is in this thing. But it's fun. It does have a picture of that classically gross fruitcake with the discolored I don't know what. Like, you know, you got the maraschino cherries, and those are identifiable, but I have no idea what anything else is. But, yes,
Sorry, I just realized that there was an audio that I didn't play. Go ahead.
Aw. To be making this little fruitcake. I love the alliteration in bustled briskly about. I felt like that gave that a little levity and texture there. The secret ingredient, that she's finally sharing with her daughter. And if her neighbors knew what was in it, everyone would be totally put out. I don't know if that's a play on words with, like, put out, leaving with everyone, Or is there some, like, drug in there that, like, knocks people out? Like, she's making her fruitcake with NyQuil? Or what exactly is in this fruitcake?
I thought it was supposed to be pissed. Like, because to rhyme with list, everyone would be totally pissed.
That would make sense. I didn't think about that. I was like, what is in this fruitcake? They would be totally pissed. So what would be in this fruitcake that would make everyone, like, is it just pissed as in, makes me wonder if it's not the American. I, of course, when I think pissed, I think angry. But, you know, more British, English, pissed is drunk. So maybe there's just, like, half a bottle of rum in this thing. Either way, any interpretation is entertaining because she's either getting everyone drunk or maybe putting them on the judges. Either one's entertaining. But I think it's probably the alcohol. So I enjoyed it. If you put enough alcohol in there, people won't care what it tastes like. It was fun, right?
I definitely think...
I enjoyed the happy taste of the fruitcake prompt. It's much brighter than the prompt. So, well
done. Weaver is British, or at least sounds British to me, so I believe pissed, as in drunk, was the goal there. I'd love to play her audio, so if we have time at the end, let's go back and play that one. We are now on to prompt 4. When you're grown up, will we still be friends? Truman Capote, A Christmas Memory. So that one here is by Marion Kilmer. And Babbler, why don't you go ahead and read that one?
Absolutely. Will we still be friends? By Marion Kilmer. This poem is for Fred, whom I've known since he was a bump on his mother's tummy. I have so many glad and happy memories of Fred as he began to babble. By 4 years old, he sat with me on the couch, rapidly explaining in terms I would never understand the glories of whatever new game he was mastering at the time. We told each other stories. We reveled together in the tasty treats his father baked. By the time he was 6, we were fast friends. He doled out some of the best hugs any child ever gave me, gentle, firm, and lingering. One day when I was in my early 50s, I felt compelled by some impetuous instinct to ask a question that surprised us both. Fred, do you think we'll still be friends when you're 21? He hesitated, musing. I don't know, he honestly replied. You'll probably be really old by then. The best part was when he was in his middle teens, reading a fantasy series about feral cats. I took them up, and we conversed about them every week. We had our own private book club. The rest of the group were only members of the audience. Fred went to college, grew long hair, got much better at playing the French horn. He is now 26, and I am 71. We still converse, share jokes, and chatter on about politics and values. My question has been answered. I got old. I got my wish. Fred is still my friend.
Oh, that is, like, seriously so heartwarming. I love it. And I love that they read, I'm pretty sure, the Warrior series by Aaron Hunter, and they had, like, their own little book club of it. That's the best.
That could have been...
I'm pretty sure that's what it was. And there are like a million books in that series. I'm pretty sure Aaron Hunter is more than one person, because I'm like, seriously, Aaron, you're writing like 4 books a month? I don't think so. If so, Aaron is a very fast writer. Watch, I'm going to get like sued by Aaron Hunter. Like, how dare you suggest such a thing? I think that is really sweet. And this sounds like a great... cross-generational friendship. Listening to him about his gaming, talking about, you know, sharing the food, talking about the future, talking about everything, reading the books and talking about it, instruments. You know, I think it's really beneficial to people for people to have friendships with people who are different ages than them, and learning from each other, especially, you know, if he didn't have, say, a grandparent in his life, then having someone with an age gap can be really cool. You get to learn a different perspective on things. I enjoyed this very much, Miriam.
I also really enjoyed it. It was very heartwarming, you know, to know someone from the time that they're born until they're an adult and maintain that friendship. So much of it is just about spending time. Like, if you really want to be someone's friend, just make the time for them. You know, and it sounds like they just both made the time, which is really great. Friendships don't necessarily, they don't have to be people the same age as you. I have tons of friends that are all kinds of different ages from me. I find that really enriching for me as a person, you know, to hear people's experiences across a broad age range. So I really enjoyed it. It was just so sweet, you know, all the different memories that they've shared together, you know, from being born to learning to talk, to playing games, to reading books, to, you know, just the lifetimes of memories that you stack up with someone. I hope there's many more, because it's so sweet. It's just nice to hear, you know, good news and good relationships and an excellent friendship. So, well done. We're all feeling a little warmer this one.
I think based on the title, we got to be prepared to be sad again. This next poem is Lost Christmas by Betty Page. Lost Christmas. Sometimes I dream that I'll meet you at your new house, where we'll run and play, as we did before. We'll do our hair, then makeup, roam around the streets, go to the movies, or cross the street to the park, chew on bubblegum, wear lip gloss, high heels, we'll even look like grown-ups. We could own the night. Keep in touch so long, only to part ways again. I can't stand this pain. So I don't go there. I built my walls up so high, none can penetrate. Yes, I am alone. I'm just so lost this Christmas. As which came before. Every year, same thing. Emptiness consumes me fierce. And I just don't care. End poem.
Great read, Athesiana. As whereas last one the answer was yes, this one the answer is no. They aren't friends when they're growing up. It just leaves them really empty. I love the images of childhood here that are chosen, you know, just running around doing hair and makeup, playing dress, roaming through the streets, which is something I don't feel like kids now get to do. The kid is literally, we ran around the streets in like gaggles, like little gangs of children with no parental supervision of any kind. I don't think that happens anymore, but it was a good time. We did get up to some shenanigans, but, we were kids. Just all these little bits that make up childhood, you know, going to the movies, playing in the park, dressing up to look like adults when you aren't one. And yet that all just kind of falls apart, just not friends anymore. Whether or not that's because there was some horrible breakup or if things just drifted as they do, it doesn't really say. But, to be alone on Christmas and just think of, you know, what happened to all the people that I called friends. You can build new friendships. You can make new memories. But not if you have walls up. So it's just kind of a heartbreaking piece. And then to just end, and I just don't care. It's interesting because it both says I don't care, but it also says I really do care, but I'm just not willing to change. Which is just a challenge. So, I thought this was a great write. Significantly more painful than the last one, but well done. Thank you, Betty. Your thoughts, Casey Anna.
I think it's well done, and it's sad. You know, it touches on those key moments of kind of like, I'm mostly picturing like 10 to 12 years old when you're like first like, oh, makeup is cool, and we're going to do our hair and go to the park and go to a movie, like, by ourselves kind of thing, like that kind of middle school age. And then it seems like they tried to keep in touch at long distance, kept in touch so long, only to part ways again. And there's that painfulness of drifting apart that it does make it harder to get close to people. And I think that happens to a lot of people with their, you know, their childhood friends, especially if you move away. I, for a while, felt like I was collecting people to miss because I would move, you know, to a different city for university, and then I would move to another city for university, and then I moved for a job. And it was like, you know, there's all these people who you slowly lose contact with, and it really, really sucks. I've been lucky that I have a few friends from, like, when I was 6 years old who I'm still really close with, but that's a rare exception, and I think she captures that, you know, longing for nostalgia and how at holidays or special events, that's when you realize who isn't there. You know, even something as simple as, like, if you're mailing out Christmas cards, which I don't actually do because I'm the worst, but, like, you know, having that person who you naturally kind of want to write a card for, and then you're like, I don't even know her current address. Where is she now? And then there's that realization of, like, you're not still friends the way that you imagined you would be. BFFs, not actually forever. So, yeah, it's a sad one, but I think she develops it well.
Yeah, agreed. You know, you do feel who's not there at a holiday, especially if it's a key person in your life. Yeah, no, it's well done. It's a great write. It's just also a sad write. Thank you, Betty.
Yep.
I think we
this
have
next
time
poem,
maybe one. Oh, go ahead.
Yep. I do think we can fit this at least this one more, and we have an audio for it. It's for prompt 5. One by one, the household emerges, looking as though they'd like to kill us both, but it's Christmas, so they can't. So this one is by Richard Wiseman, and we're going to play his audio.
The Household Emerges by Richard Wiseman. Little Big Sister first, her floral pajamas quick catch in interior wintry winds, now dagger eyes upon us. Her venomous fangs hiss us to the back. The lemon-colored kitchen's corner. Her white, blinding hunger pangs rumble deeper as she pulls a chair and, standing 7 foot high, parses through top shelf with its jelly jars of preserve, coffee cans, and Kahlua bottles, searching for Tony or the captain. Big Sister next, humming Blackbird. I ask, why don't we have a tree? Her eyes roll as she counts scoops of Maxwell House, then flips the silvery metal switch. Soon after, the percolator vomits its light brown fluid up into its see-through glass crown. Brother takes the traffic-worn blue-carpeted stairs 3 at a time, bearing brown rice from the garage's storage shed. As he pours it into the boiling saucepan, I ask, why don't we celebrate Christmas? Head behind the New York newsprint, Dad readies his battle-wearied mind for another 25th of December, immune to the call for anything at all. Finally, Mom emerges, hungover and life-beaten, wailing for order and kippers and eggs. We crowd round, hushed, and wait for Boxing Day with its champagne celebration of this household's hairline fractured anniversary. End of poem.
enjoyed this. There was so much in here that even brought nostalgia for me, but at the same time felt like watching the Jewish version of Home Alone. You know, the little sister coming out almost like a beast, you know, venomous fangs, digging for cereal. And I think we all had this covered, right? It's not like the weird mix of stuff in it. It's like the doesn't fit in other drawers cupboard. at least for me. And I love the descriptions in here, the specific things, you know, like the lemon-colored kitchen. You know, it's Maxwell House coffee. So I can picture, you know, like the blue plastic container that comes in. And I love that sister's just drinking coffee. You know, and this kid is just going, why don't we celebrate Christmas? Why don't we have a Christmas tree? And just no one's even answering. They're just so tired of hearing it that it's just like, just shut up. You know, dad is just, you know, ready to brace his way through another December, 25th of December, just tired of hearing it again. And I love it because the quote is, you know, one by one, the household emerges looking as though they'd like to kill us both, but it's Christmas, so they can't. You know, in this case, it's just like, will you shut up about Christmas? Which I love. You know, and mom coming out waiting for an order of Kipper's eggs. My mom loves Kippers, the little Kipper snack, the little fish in the tin. She ate those, like, all growing up. So now I have, like, a nostalgia craving sometimes for, like, the tins of oysters, which smell really pungent. So, you know, I try to eat them, like, privately and alone at night. So I don't know what else has to feel about it smells. But it's just a nostalgia thing for me. You know, and then what they do celebrate is Boxing Day, you know, the day after Christmas when it's everything, you know, there's all these sales and putting everything away. It's not really celebrated so much in the U.S. I think I've seen it more recently than I did as a kid, you know, Boxing Day thing. But, see, you know, you see that, the celebrating December 26th. I do see here in the footnote, too, it says that Boxing Day was his parents' anniversary. So they were looking forward to celebrating their marriage the next. I did this right. It was great. So, you know, and kids going, why don't we celebrate Christmas? Everyone else is celebrating Christmas. We don't have a tree. And just nobody even feeling like dealing with it. So, I loved it. It was wry and enjoyable. Your thoughts, Tiziana?
I liked it. I liked that it had sort of the different perspectives of the different kids. You know, just their focus at that time. The little sister who's just determined to get her cereal. And I like that it doesn't say cereal. It's like searching for Tony or the captain, but you know it's cereal she's looking for. And then when the older sister is making the coffee, the way that it's described. The percolator vomits its light brown fluid up into its see-through glass crown. I love that description. You know, that mom is life-beaten, wailing for order. And there's just that hushed waiting for when they're actually going to have the party the next day. Although it seems like, you know, the marriage they're celebrating might not be great because of the hairline fractured anniversary. It's, you know, there's some tension there, but maybe just because of the whole Christmas thing and that kid who's just not understanding why they're not in on the holiday. I like the detail of the blue carpeted stairs. And that it's traffic worn. So the fact that it's traffic worn tells me it's the kind of carpet that, like, sticks up. Like, maybe not quite shag carpet, but, like, long carpet. And you can see, like, the path that people have taken on it. And bearing brown rice from the garage, at first I was picturing that the rice was stuck to the bottom of his socks, and he was, like, leaving that trail in the carpet, but then I realized he's probably, like, carrying it to the kitchen to cook. At first, I was picturing it in the carpet because it was a long carpet, and it just created a kind of tactile feel of, like, ooh, I could step on that. Very well done, Richard. I'm happy that you gave us the audio for it as well. That was a very nice touch. Now, I don't think we have time to read and discuss any new poems. And that was the last one for that contest. The other ones are carryovers. So they're going to get carried over again. But because we don't have time to discuss it, I think what I'm going to do is play the audio that we already discussed the poem, but you can just listen to it now in the author's voice, in the poet's voice. So in case we get cut off, Merry Christmas, everyone. Happy holidays, whatever other holiday that you are celebrating right now. And I hope that you have a wonderful weekend. I'm going to play the audio by Weaver.
It's fine to be an average fan of fruitcake. I would not wish to alter that at all. But if you can give me just a moment, I'd like to share a tale that I recall. It was a few weeks before Christmas, as Mrs. Jones bustled briskly about, ready to make her finest fruitcake, to be the winner at the fete, no doubt, complete with its secret ingredient, handed down ad infinitum, it is said. This recipe was never written down. It was all safely stored in her head. This year was going to be different. Mrs. Jones had decided it was time to let her daughter know every part of what made this fruitcake sublime. She was bound to be shocked, of course. That was why there was no written list. If her neighbours knew what was in it, everyone would be totally put out.
Great audio, Weaver. I'm sorry that I missed that before. And we do have 2 minutes left, so Babbler, do you have any final comments?
Just want to thank everyone for writing in for the Christmas contest. I'm glad that, you know, people seem to find it inspiring. I did enjoy that little tidbit of humor in that one, too. And I feel like the audio really added to it. So, yeah, well done. I don't know if you have any contests or anything like that going, Faziana.
I do. So I have a contest called Bleeding Love, and the quotes for that are, "What if someone had told us that we didn't have to be bleeding in order to be open?" which is by Blythe Baird. And prompt two, "When you are not fed love on a silver spoon, you have to learn to lick it off of knives," by Lauren Eden. So you can write to those quotes in my contest. And that will be for next week. Good night, everyone.
Good night.